Hi, everyone. I want to welcome you to No Alcohol, No Problem, Brewing and Evaluating Low and Alcohol, No Alcohol Beers. I get the pleasure of introducing Megan Anderson to you. But first of all, I'm Melissa McCann. I'm with the governing committee, your governing committee of the American Home Brewers Association. And before we get started, we don't need to talk about that. There's plenty of people. There's plenty of room. I'm excited about this. We want to be sure you're silencing your cell phones. We'll be taking questions at the end of the session, and we'll ask you to come to the front of the room and speak into the microphone so that that's all recorded for everyone. There's also going to be the QR code for you, and just to remind you that you have access to hundreds of recordings of past presentations that you can refer back to. Finally, at the end of the session, we want to talk about submitting your feedback for this session so that we can improve and keep moving forward in the AHA. And I want to introduce you to Megan Anderson. She's been in the business for 17 different years. She's a founder of the Aficionado program that you're going to hear about today, as well as Transcending Trauma, which is an amazing program that I happen to be a part of. And she'll probably speak a little bit about that to you today. So, Megan Anderson. All right. Good morning, everyone. Wow, all the chipper early people that are like non-alcoholic beer like me. I love it. All right, so I think you can access the slides if you want. Like Melissa mentioned, the slides are in there if you like to access that and have a look. But yeah, I'll just take a second here to tell you a little bit more about myself. My name is Megan Anderson. This is not my first homebrew con, but my first one as a speaker. It reminded me of my very first one I attended and why it was so special to me. So I thought I would share that with a group because it's kind of part of my journey. I've been in the industry for 17 years, and I spent the majority of my career at the Boston Beer Company at Sam Adams. I knew nothing about beer or brewing, joined the industry, and in shortly after I started there, I was working in Texas, the Texas market, and I moved down to San Antonio. And is anyone here from the San Antonio? Are you in the Service Aeros?
Yes.
Awesome. Okay, so I was at the very first San Antonio Service Aeros meeting that was ever held. It was me and like 8 people. And I wore my Sam Adams t-shirt, and I brought my Boston Lager, and I told the story of Jim homebrewing Boston Lager in his kitchen. And I catch a glimpse of a guy sitting kind of at the corner of the table, and he has like a bird feather in his cap, and just kind of, you know, stood out for even in the homebrewing crowd, which is always unique. And he said, I used to own a brewery, you know, back in the day in California. And I was like, interesting. And Boston Beer, if you know anything about Sam Adams, we spend a tremendous amount of money on education. So you've probably seen like cool Sam Adams educational stuff in the market. And when we first started training in education, they educate you about the whole category. So they really start with like the roots of homebrewing in the U.S. and people that opened the first breweries in the U.S. Like I got thinking, I'm like, I might know who this guy is from my training. I'm like, you know, no offense, sir, but you're look a little older than me. So what brewery were you a part of? Where did you start it? He's like, I started New Albion Brewing in 1977. I was like, holy moly, are you Jack McAuliffe? We've been looking for you. You know, where have you been? And turned out he'd been living in San Antonio, and I personally got to know him and brew some beers with him, and just got to thinking, like, wow, you know, I should probably tell somebody at work about this. So I called Jim. I'm like, Jim, I met Jack McAuliffe at the San Antonio Service Aeros homebrew meeting. He's like, Megan, nobody knows where this guy really is. You know, we should meet him sometime. He goes, also, you might want to let him know we own New Albion. maybe he wanted to know that. I was like, oh, okay, I'll let him know. And I actually went to his house, and he was teaching a bunch of us to make sausage, which is like a whole nother complex home thing to do. And if you know Jack, there was plenty of beer there and plenty of random people. And I tell him this, you know, like, hey, Jack, you know, I talked to Jim, and we own New Albion now. You know, Jim bought it when the trademark became available to have it remain sort of in the craft realm. And I just never will forget the look on Jack's face. Like, it was something, it just sparked something in him, like it was still alive. And the following year, I was able to make an introduction between Jack and Jim at the Great American Beer Festival.
And that meeting led us to rebrew New Albion. We actually found the original yeastland at UC Davis, which was really cool, and we rebrewed the original recipe of New Albion Pale Ale and re-released it to the United States market for the first time in 35 years and gave Jack and his daughter Renee the company back. So that's kind of like one thing I'm really proud of. I learned a lot about brewing, and I got into home brewing because of Sam Adams, because they encouraged us to do that. And that comes full circle in my talk today, because one of the guys I brewed this beer with, he actually had won the Sam Adams homebrew competition, which is kind of cool. But what I'm up to these days? So I spent 10 years at Sam Adams. Then I went on into the commercial hops industry, so some of you guys in here might know me from that. I did some work with Mill 95, which was a commercial processing startup in Idaho. I ran sales and marketing for them as a startup, and then I moved to CalSec. So I spent a couple years at CalSec working in advanced hop extracts, and that's where I started to learn about NA beer actually being a thing, because, you know, we were making beers with the big brewers, and none of them were really talking to us about regular beers. This would have been like 2019, right before COVID. Then I went on to get involved with NZ Hops Limited. I ran their business unit for the United States for 18 months and released Nectaron into the U.S. market and commercialized that. We made that a top 10 hop in the United States, which was a great program. Worked with Dr. Ron Beetson, and there's an amazing team of people running that now. Then I went into the cannabis industry because, you know, why not? I actually sold cigarettes at the beginning of my career, then went into beer, then cannabis, and luckily my family still invites me to Thanksgiving, so that's good. And that's just a whole nother crazy industry. I actually work in hemp beverage now. I got out of adult use cannabis because it's just too crazy, and I'm a consultant only for that business now. But what I found in the meantime, when I got out of cannabis last year, I'm like, what am I going to do? I'd had this big transformation in my life since from between 20, I keep slapping that thing, 2020 and 2022, and it was that I had adapted a zero-proof lifestyle. So in my career in the brewing industry, for me personally, I just noticed as the years went on, I wasn't looking any better or feeling any better, and that actually ended up revealing itself to be something quite bigger to me. It was actually more of an issue of my own restraint and not being able to be my best. You know, I just was a 10 IPA gal, not a 1 IPA gal, if you know what I mean. So I had this tremendous transformation. What I found was moderation didn't really work for me, so I just wanted to switch to, I love beer, and I couldn't really imagine my life without it. My last role at Boston Beer, I was the beer education manager for North America. Like, what beer education manager doesn't drink beer, right? So I had to figure out how to navigate this industry and not lose what I loved about it. And so as I got here, which if you saw the picture of me from like 2018 or before, you'd be like, you look like you could be your own daughter. So some of the things I'll also talk to you about today are like some of the reasons you guys might want to try this out. Even if it's only on your homebrew schedule a few times a year, there's actual benefit to putting these beverages in your brewing schedule from a wellness standpoint. But I felt so much better, and I was like, now what am I going to do? And I was like, yeah, I don't even have to work hard. Like the craft guys back in the day, you had to homebrew your own beers because all you could drink was mass domestic, right? I had all these amazing commercial varietals of non-alcoholic beer available to me from the time I became alcohol-free, so it was like very easy. So in this regard, we're almost working backwards, right? Like the big guys already had recipes for this ready to scale, and then when consumer demand was ready, they released them. We had a big craft following, and now it's kind of coming into the homebrewing realm, which is why I'm here today. So I founded Aficionado in October of last year. It is the world's first training and certification program dedicated to alcohol-free and non-alcoholic beer, wine, spirits, and cannabis beverage. So I really wanted to be an advocate for the category and just begin to educate with objective knowledge around the real opportunity behind AF and NA beer. Because these products are not encumbered by the same licensing requirements at retail as regular alcoholic beer, and because they're low in alcohol or have no alcohol, you can drink them any time of day. So think about the opportunity for the category now, right? So I'll talk about that a little bit in a minute. So I founded Aficionado as a result of I had a lot of extra time on my hands, you know, when I wasn't like thinking about drinking, planning to drink, or recovering from drinking. So I did an MBA in sustainable business and started studying human consciousness. So last year I also founded Transcending Trauma, which teaches a mental technique, transcendental meditation, to survivors of the of gender-based trauma in the industry. And Melissa is a part of that, which is cool. So I needed a way to fund that. So I was like, better write a training program. Non-alcoholic beer sounds like the right way. So that's what I did. So today I want to talk a little bit about the history of the category, including the position of the category today, which is just kind of interesting why we're here. Sensory differences and expectations for NA beer. But more importantly, let's just talk about my experiment of brewing it at home. This was a good opportunity for me to learn how to do that in talking on this subject. So I just want to share with you guys what we learned. And then I brought some samples of the homebrew I made. And I think based on the audience, we should have enough for everybody to taste, which is cool. But just kind of looking at the market overall, so if you're going to go to a grocery store and buy some to try to figure out a recipe or just see what's out there, there are hundreds of commercial examples now. I promise you I'll have no problem finding something that you like, but there is a difference on the label and how we regulate and view these products in the U.S. So I thought I'd start there with an explanation. So what we have here is alcohol-free beers must be verified as no detectable alcohol. So they must be below 0.05%. So close to 0.5, another zero, no detectable alcohol. So below the threshold of instrumentation on those things. Commercial brands that would be available that would meet that would be Saria has a 0.0, Budweiser 0, no detectable alcohol. Non-alcoholic beer in the United States is where we have a little bit more leeway, and it represents a really big opportunity, not only in the home brewing sector, but in the craft sector, is anything less than 0.5% alcohol. So between 0.0 and 0.49, and those commercial brands, you probably, anybody out here seen Athletic Brewing Company on the shelf? Anybody? Yeah, okay. Lagunitas has an IPNA, awesome. Sam Adams, Just the Haze, so there's some really good examples there. Of these different products that are available. So just wanted to put that on your radar, that alcohol-free and non-alcoholic are different class designations here in the U.S. So let's go back. Like, why and when did non-alcoholic beer become a thing? And it really does have some historical context to it and related to beer as a matrix, as an amazing delivery system and use for medicinal purposes in human history. So there's some chemical analysis and some studies that we came across just showing that in ancient Sudan, the Nubian tribes about 2,000 years ago were ingesting antibiotics with beer as supposedly as the matrix. So, you know, kind of thinking about how beer was always just considered very nourishing, very healing, had wellness properties to it. And, you know, obviously these were low ABV, low gravity beers back in our sort of in the Fertile Crescent. So special brews of beer that were being used for medicinal purposes. So really interesting that these things, people would ingest them and knew they worked. They just didn't know why. And alcohol-free beer certainly played a part of that, or low alcohol beer certainly. But let's look into the more recent history, because, you know, we just didn't know really anything about fermentation. We didn't understand yeast and the biological methods until really modern brewing, if you think about it. So I'll start on the very far left here. So there's an image of a water pump with a skeleton on it and a lot of sick people around it. So this is referring to the outbreak of a deadly cholera outbreak in London in the 1850s. So in the mid-19th century, this was before we understood from a contamination standpoint that water could carry pathogens that could make people sick. And cholera outbreaks were common. Illnesses were common in places where people lived in large populations and were, you know, drinking and all using the same water source and would often end up contaminated because waste, animal and human waste, would make it in there and disease pathogens would grow. So this is important to remember for later of how we're going to keep those pathogens out of our beer in the modern era. So this particular outbreak killed, I believe, over 600 people. And it started with a woman at near this street in London called Broad Street in a neighborhood. And my understanding is her infant had passed away, and she had put the infant's clothing after death into the area where the water was being pumped. And from there, families were then pumping those pathogens into their own water and consuming them and dying. And this guy, this is not a joke, his name was, if you're a Game of Thrones fan, his name was Jon Snow. He was a very brave scientist, and he went out and he was like, I got to figure this out. I got to go into this area and contain this issue. And he had been onto it. He thought it was coming from the water, but he wasn't sure. So he went door to door and interviewed everyone in this neighborhood. And many of them had lost family members as a result of this cholera outbreak. Well, then he stumbles upon, like, in this neighborhood, he hears, like, some, you know, hears some industrial sounds, and it's a brewery. And he goes into the brewery, and everybody there is fine. So that led him to a major breakthrough in his understanding that in those beverages, people were, they were drinking them and not getting sick, and the water people were dying, so they just removed the handle from the pump, and people stopped getting sick. This was a, seems very simple, but this was a major discovery point at that time, because at least we understood that it was coming from the water, and then from there we saw a tremendous amount of breakthroughs medically. So beer really, and alcohol, if you think about it, played a really important role in human health for a long time because pathogens couldn't grow in it, so you couldn't get sick. So that was really important. But then we get into to more modern times and maybe start to see some of the more negative consequences of alcohol consumption when it isn't mindful or it begins to really infiltrate the culture. So I love this center picture. This is a picture that's referring to, you know, the late 19th century and early 20th century movements from the Women's Christian Temperance Union. And they would go into bars and hold up signs and sit outside bars while in this era, the traditionally male population would be in these bars consuming spirits and beer. And this was very disturbing about what are some of the more negative consequences of consuming too much alcohol, right? So these were the early movements that actually led to prohibition. So then we see major controls come down in 1919 when the 18th Amendment was passed, which was a huge issue, obviously. And then you have a major shift in the way that brewing is occurring in the United States and really what happens to our culture. So then we move beyond that after the Prohibition era. I like we're in this era now, right? Like beer is social, it's fun. We think about it like when we're having a party. It's, you know, it's a big thing for like a coming of age and youth these days. So now we're almost back to like the opposite where it's really about individual responsibility. You know, you need to handle alcohol and choose how to consume wisely. And then, we had to wait until consumers became individually self-aware of this for this category to become relevant again. So breweries had to survive somehow. So this is our very first soiree into soda, right? Like people had to convert. These companies had to survive. So they started thinking of other types of beverages that they could make with their existing input material during Prohibition. And it really stayed that way, where these soda evolved as its own brand stream. These malt-based, low-alcohol drinks were, I mean, let's be honest, kind of a stigma. Like for people that were in AA or some, you know, if you talk to normal people, and that's kind of the perception that people had. These non-alcoholic beers don't taste good, but they're for pregnant ladies and people that can't handle their alcohol, right? So that's like how it looked today. Well, then COVID happened, and I think everybody at least probably read one story or knows somebody who said, man, I really drank a lot of alcohol during COVID, and I was impacted by it in my life by COVID, and you know, so I knew somebody that, you know, was harmed by it, and I started thinking about health and wellness differently. So it really did sort of change, and you know, particularly in the United States, the way that people are sort of perceiving these types of beverages. So I started looking into this when I created Aficionado. I'm like, I got to understand, like, what is the market potential? Like, this thing can't be that big. Well, it's not yet, but with this accelerated growth and all these offerings, it's reflective of consumer behavior. So I was like, so what are the consumers drinking? Well, 75% of consumers, by the way, they're also still drinking regular alcoholic products more often than not. I'm actually in the minority. Only about 23% of people that consume non-alcoholic and alcohol-free adult beverage are abstainers like I am now. But the rest of them are people that still enjoy regular alcoholic drinks and just choose to integrate these products, you know, for their benefits of being low in alcohol. So 75% of those no alcohol sales are actually made up of AF and NA beer. How exciting, right? So you guys are at the forefront of thinking about crafting your own rendition of this at home and competing in this category. So this is going to outpace certainly beer, regular craft and domestic beer growth, but all alcohol beverage growth for the next 5+ years, likely longer. If you look into the global market, you know, right now, let's say that we're probably about 0.5% share of total alc bev for beer. maybe even a little bit lower. In Europe, in Spain and Germany, we're talking 12-13% of the market. Mahou makes over 2.2 million hectoliters of non-alcoholic beer because their culture is different. It's totally normal to sit in a beer garden there all day, and it's also just a different, when you have advancements in technology and products that are available, you can sit in a beer garden for 12 hours and drink and actually be quite functional with mindful drinking application. So this is really appealing to those consumers. The global market is valued at $22 billion, so we have a lot of upside here. But we're seeing it come online in the commercial realm. So JetBlue actually recently entered into a partnership with Athletic Brewing Company. You can order and drink NA beer on your flights now. How cool is that? I don't have to just sneak them in my purse anymore. I'm always the creeper at events. People are like, you can't have that. You're in a restaurant. I'm like, I don't care. I bring my own NA beer. Try to stop me. And you can see the shelf sets are growing. So I really enjoy being in the category and writing a certification program that I can help take to the market. We're planning to teach this to distributors and retailers that are in the category so they know how to serve and sell these products and what the different ways that they're made. So I just thought this slide was cool because at the bottom it reminded me that as all of us that love the industry, and there's lots of ways we could say that like NA beer is going to crush the category, you know, there's a lot of ways we could look at it negatively. My goal with this program is to actually not do any of that. I think that actually non-alcoholic beer represents a bigger growth driver than people even realize for the entire beer category, because again, now you can drink beer any time of day and you don't need a liquor license for these products because they're not classified as beer because they're below 0.5%. So it's kind of cool. And because these products work so well, and actually, in my opinion, are better when you use components, hop-derived components in them to modify them, that represents a big opportunity for all my friends out there in the hops industry. So really quick, let's just review how these types of beers are made, at least at an industrial scale. So in case you're wondering, like, how are people typically doing this? And if you're here, you might not know this already. So there's some mechanical methods we can use. These technologies really haven't changed much. This is what the same way like O'Doul's and these products have been being made. So you're using either RO filtration, so we're just filtering out the ethanol molecule, or we're using borrowing from other industries, and we're using mechanical distillation via vacuum rectification, often at ambient temperature. So we're boiling at ambient by using a lot of pressure, and from there we're able to basically volatilize off the ethanol, collect it. Many of these companies then advertise that you have now booze you can put in your seltzer or whatever, so we're trying to be sustainable there. And you can also save some of the volatile compounds and introduce those back in. So some of these cool aroma compounds that come off during this process can be reintroduced to make them more robust. But biological methods have really become a more viable way. So I wouldn't imagine anybody here, if you are in craft brewing or the industry, or you're just a fan because you're home brewing, that craft brewers can afford this type of capital expenditure if they decide to get into this game. So biological methods and starting at the homebrew level are really a great way to play with this. If I were a brewer, and actually when I consult with brewers, I tell them basically homebrew in NA using a biological method. Then you can start to understand how this, you don't need the CapEx expenditure, and with the right processes and controls, you can brew these in your own brewery. Service can be a little bit more difficult because, pasteurization and stuff, so we acknowledge that. But if the brewery you're able to use sterile filtration, you can really protect yourself from any risk. But really, the most efficient way and effective way to brew, in my opinion, to brew a quality NA beer is using these biological methods. So there's so many amazing yeast strains now that have been adapted because of the demand in the market. So again, you guys don't have to like really struggle for it. If you want to make these at home, it's actually quite easy. So what are we going to do? How are we going to do that? We're going to restrict the development of alcohol. So there's a number of methods we're going to talk about. We also have to account for the growth of pathogens because we don't want to create a Broad Street pump problem in our own neighborhood. So we got to be careful about that. You also kind of want to consider the different yeast strains. You're going to get different properties out of them because, these volatile organic compounds are going to form. We're still forming some low levels of alcohol. So you just want to decide how that fits into the brew that you're making. And some of these experimental strains, just to describe how they're made and where they come from, as you look at Lallemand and White Labs, they're coming from other specific environments, like from kombucha and other types of low fermentation beverages. And we're targeting them for those desirable characteristics of limited alcohol production and novel flavor. So when we're doing that with yeast, there's a couple of different methods that we can use there. The first is just arrested fermentation, so we're not going to ferment for very long. We're going to stop fermentation with standard yeast. We could do a limited fermentation with a maltose negative or maltotriose negative yeast strain, which is what we used. And there is some interesting literature about cold contact fermentation, although that seems to be a little bit more difficult. So we did not use that during ours. So I should also say that you can brew regular beer and then you can boil off the alcohol. I just kind of skipped over that because I feel like that's just too old school for where we are now. I wouldn't recommend making your beer that way because I just feel like you're not going to get a quality product whenever we do that.
About how long would you have to boil off a standard 5% beer for that to
happen? I think there is a calculation for that, for how long you should do it. I don't want to guess, but I want to say it was like around 30 minutes or something like that. But I'm not 100% sure. It might be much shorter. I've never done it. And I haven't read too much about it, only because just as somebody working in professional brewing, I would never recommend that somebody heat their beer like that. I think there's another question. I think they wanted him at the mic, but if it's quick, you can shout it out. Yes.
Those chemicals, full of compounds, they're so important to flavor. You can add them back in otherwise. You add them back in with that.
Yes, yeah, you can add them back in, right? And in the case of ours, we actually did that. We actually did have to add back in some flavor, so I'm going to tell you guys how that worked out for us. How to avoid pitfalls. So full disclosure, this is my very first NA homebrew, right? I sell to commercial breweries and I teach at the commercial level. So this provided an amazing opportunity for me to do it myself, just to test this. And so I wanted to talk to some other folks who had been doing this for a long time. So I just thought it worthy to point out that this group, they're out of Australia. They have a website called Ultra Low Brewing. Please write it down. Please go to their Facebook page and website. They have brewed hundreds and hundreds of NA beers using all different kinds of methods, and they've got scientific rigor. And I just think, like, wow, they should definitely be guests here sometime. I learned a lot from them. They were very friendly. They were super excited I was coming here to speak, and they provided us some of the pointers. So I just kind of wanted to highlight what they did. So these guys just did a really great job. We talked to them. We talked to other brewers. I collaborated on this beer with a guy who's... funny enough, his name is Josh Brewer. He's won homebrew competitions. He won the Sam Adams homebrew competition one year, and he wanted to learn how to make NA beer too, and he has an incredible setup, so I actually went out to Asheville to brew this with him. So him and I did a little research with the Ultra Low Brewing guys. We hit them up and talked to them before, and we really came up with, like, this is borrowed from White Lab's slide, but I just thought this was great. It comes down to the same problems you have in the commercial side, right? How are you going to produce the wort and make it ideal for these conditions, your fermentation process and having the right controls and right yeast strain, and then stabilization. Because I'm just going to say it again, we don't have alcohol in there. So if we think back, pathogens can grow, meaning we're really creating a food. So when we say that beer is liquid bread, right, and actually that's kind of funny because bread itself typically has a higher ABV in it, if you think about alcohol level in it, concentration of ethanol, than a lot of it. NA beers you'll find on the shelf, which people find pretty interesting. But you got to stabilize it. So we got to prevent pathogens from growing in there. It was a really great day. This is his setup. It was mostly like a contained process, which I really liked. So for those of you that have those types of systems in your home brewing clubs or on your own, I just think the less you have to move the product around and you can keep it transferring, keep it transferring without contacting many things, that's a good thing. But it was a very nice setup. The guy there on the left is actually, he's a journalist for Good Beer Hunting and Final Gravity magazine. I didn't know that they found out we were doing this, and he ended up driving from New York to Asheville to join us for the day, and I think we're in Final Gravity magazine this month talking about this story, and then Good Beer Hunting's putting out some stuff on the non-alcoholic endeavors that are going on, I think, later this month, too. But we decided to brew an NA IPA mostly because I know at the end of the day, hops can, like, save these things because I've saved them for other breweries before. So I'm like, don't worry. If we screw it up, We can fix it with hops. So luckily, that's what we did. But when I got, just to kind of point out what you're going to want to do and these conditions you're going to want to set up. So in terms of structuring how we talked about here, your wort production, we want to create something that's not very fermentable, right? So we're going to do mash for 30 minutes. So it's like a super quick, literally cooking it really quickly. And your efficiency then is going to be about 45%. So it's not meant to be efficient, right? We're just trying to create like a flavorful base that's gonna drive out some of these desirable flavors that we want, because we can get a buildup of undesirable flavors for many reasons in non-alcoholic beer. You're going to do a really quick boil addition for 45 minutes, 30 to 45 minutes, fast fermentation typically, because again, there's not a whole lot of sugar there to begin with. So, and then you don't have as much carbonation, so you do need to account for that. These are some of the things that we knew in advance were going to happen. And just again, please watch for contamination points, because things can grow in here. And again, if you still have yeast contact and you have it cold crashed and things, just remember fermentation can still happen. Depending on your mash efficiency. But ideally, I mean, everybody in here knows the basics of brewing, right? So beta and alpha amylase are activated at lower temperatures than this. So we're just coming in right above that, and we're just, those enzymes aren't becoming active and doing what they're supposed to do, but there's still enough, there's a little bit of fermentability in there. Look at this, started where most beers finish, right? We're starting at 10:17. And finishing at 10:14, And I say no and low, because the ultra low brewing guys, I mean, you might have a beer that comes out at like 0.9%, or some of theirs 1.1. Good. To me, those are kind of like in the same realm as this. I think what I wanted to point out is just what's available on the shelf doesn't necessarily mean that has to be what your NA beer is, and that's still okay. So just, you can still have a really nice low fermentation and, it wouldn't be suitable to be labeled non-alcoholic, but I don't want that to prevent you from trying this. Just know that there's a little wiggle room in there, and you have all the capability to measure that yourself and serve it at home. And if you, for some reason, decide you want to commercialize it, you can control those outputs later. So we really, when we made this beer, I'm like, Josh, what's our objective here? We got to have some sort of hypothesis. And ours was that, some NA beers that we'd had and tasted, had kind of, a very poor wort quality in the sensory character. It was kind of, potato chip-like, potato soup-like. Some of them really had no foam. We really wanted the beer to pour nicely and look good with foam. So we, really had set very high expectations for our first brew, and then of course I screwed it up in the boil, which I'll tell you about in a minute. But we just wanted to use a very diverse, we want to use a very diverse malt bill to create body, to mask some of those things, and also to see if we could create a good foam collar on it, because that's what we were going for. Josh is really into brewing German lagers, which any of you out there knows the guy that brews German lagers. They have a very high standard for how these things come out. So I really appreciated what he was going for here. But I knew that we were going to get great mouthfeel and also add things in there that had weren't going to affect fermentability, right? So I felt good about that. We really wanted this to be like a traditional, American IPA, so I didn't get to throw a bunch of Nectaron in there, because that would be cheating, because that's such a good hop. And so basically what we did was Cascade was supposed to go in at 30. I was so excited I dumped them all in at 30, so we knew that we were going to have to make some adjustments, because we basically had no Whirlpool hops in there. And so that's what we did. And then we did a little bit of dry hopping. But to be honest, dry hopping doesn't really work in NA beer, because you don't have ethanol in there, so you don't have a solvent. And, people do it. You can, hop water and you're going to get some flavor. But it's primarily going to be myrcene pull and not always ideal. So we did dry hop a little bit just to do it. We end up with something quite bitter. It was a little bit above 35 BUs because, I screwed up. And in our yeast, we used the White Lab 603, which is a maltose negative strain. So again, we wanted to hit that target fermentation of 66 to 68 degrees, which we did. And as you saw, fermentation went as planned. Just our hopping really didn't. So I'll come back here for a second. So how did we fix that? So we added hop oil. So coming from the hops business, I was like, hey, you know what? This is where ethanol can save us. Let's get some hop oil. Let's dilute it into an ethanol carrier, because we can account for that adjustment. And now we can use ethanol to our favor in a way that's not going to become a dominant ingredient, but it's going to act as a carrier for these solubilized hop compounds that I want to get in there to cover up all the weird flavors that I created and the bitterness that I created. So we did that. That worked out really well. We also had to charge up on carbonation because the carbonation wasn't really where we wanted it to be, and we needed to account for that as well. So I want to talk a little bit about just the sensory attributes. So, you know, basically yeast, when you take yeast off quickly, you can create some, by cold crashing, these aroma active fermentation byproducts like esters, for example, just don't have time to develop and your beer's going to taste green. So if we want to kind of avoid that, again, it's really about your yeast strain selection. And then some of these other immature characteristics can also sort of dominate, make that wort character more pronounced, which is why you'll always hear people say, it's too worty, it's too flat. So these are just some of the common things you're going to have to overcome in an NA beer. And that's primarily because this bottom compound here, I just want to make everyone aware of methionyl, it's present in, it is present in all beer, but it's not odor active in ethanol. And one way you can try this is, I don't know if you guys do this in your homebrew clubs or not, but you can buy compound malt wort compound kits from Aroxa. And I've done about 140 hours of training with Dr. Bill Simpson, so this is all his stuff, not mine. I'm not that smart. But I always am curious, like, what are the predominant aroma compounds? Because I know what we're able to extract via ethanol is going to have a way different impact than what I'm going to put in an NA beer. And I'm very interested in what I like to know is, like, I have a good nose, right? I've been trained as a... I can look for the compounds that I like and then go find them and put them in my beer, in my NA beer, which is nice. But methionyl is that boiled potato, metallic, wordy character that is very off-putting in a lot of NA beers. And I just wanted to point out that it's there no matter what. And it's a cool experiment to do if you taste like a, if you spike an NA beer with it and then you have a Bud Light, like a regular Bud Light or whatever your neutral beer is, and you just dump it in and swirl it, it's gone. So just really interesting how some of these things, you know, are behaving in that regard. So get that boiled potato character. You want to cover that up. You're also going to get Strecker aldehydes, which are really a major component of these things. So what are Strecker aldehydes? Strecker aldehydes are organic compounds that are formed during the brewing process when amino acids basically react with the carbonyl compounds like alpha keto acids. So these are really important aroma compounds in beer and then contribute to that overall beer characteristic, beer flavor profile. So methionyl is a common Strecker aldehyde and just going to be part of that. It's formed during the Maillard reaction in malting, and you know, really it can give you some favorable toasty aroma compounds, but when in very high concentrations are going to come off more of that boiled potato character. So I wouldn't expect you to find that in my beer that you're going to taste today, although you may get some of those other lower malt compounds. But these are also other Strecker aldehydes that form. Isobutyl aldehyde is another common one that you'll see, which is going to be that grainy, dusty character, if you're familiar with that. So these are just some of the common sensory attributes you're going to find, with methionyl in very high concentrations being considered an off flavor, along with other oxidative characters as well. So I want to make sure we have enough time to sample this and ask questions. So just really quick, what are my tips on brewing NA beer at home? So keep that fermentability low. Your beer is starting where other beers are finishing. So just make sure you're setting yourself up and your ingredients and recipe for that. You're just going to do this high temp fast mash. So you want to create that base. I'll speak quickly about pH, because these ultra low guys just did it. I recommend going and reading it. They actually brewed a beer using the same base and adjusted the pH to high, standard, and low, and then actually did tastings on it. We adjusted our pH to our target, I think, was 3.8. So we knew we were going to be coming down in pH out of that range. You know, and we're usually looking for pH about, what, 4.2 to 4.6 when we're brewing and pitching. We wanted to come down, and the reason why is stability. It makes it very difficult for pathogens to grow. So just, again, safety tip from myself and the people I helped write the exam with: if you're doing this at home, I would just recommend adjusting the pH down. It made me feel better about it when I was sampling people on it. I knew I was just creating very difficult conditions for pathogens to grow. And David Quain wrote a great academic article on this that you can read about, where they studied draft non-alcoholic beer in the UK, And what they found was beers that had a pH of below 3.7 basically weren't showing pathogen growth, where the other non-alcoholic beers were, especially as temperatures increased and time between line cleaning. So your yeast addition is different in a surprising way. It's easy. We didn't have to do anything. We didn't have to do any yeast starters. I mean, we just opened the packet and went. Let it rip, man. It's easy. They're just making a really beer really fast. And again, it's a really fast fermentation. There's not a lot of extra stuff you have to do. You just have to control your parameters to prevent your fermentation from going above where you want or from never starting to begin with. And then, of course, creating something that's stable. And so I think what you do is you create some targets for what do you want to express. And just know that if you're going to be trying to express hops, dry hopping ain't the way to get there. So there are options now left for that as well. So, all right, let's taste. I'd love to see what you guys think about this beer, our IPA. So we ended up using a hop oil blend, which we just diluted down into with some ethanol into some vodka, and just put a slight amount of that just to adjust for hop aroma character. But I'm really interested in what you guys think about this beer. Again, came out to just under 0.4% ABV. And yes, I think we have some questions, so I can take those now too.
Yes, I have so many questions. I came because I thought this would be interesting, and it was very interesting.
Thank you.
Interesting presentation. You keep mentioning potatoes. It's because you're mashing, but not allowing the enzymes to convert to sugars. So you're left with a wort that's all starch.
Yep.
And that's why you taste the potato thing. And so a lot of what you're doing is trying to overcome the fact that you've left so much starch in the product.
Yeah.
Is there a way to remove the starch or lower the amount of starch?
So if you use in certain extracts that you can add.
Grain selection?
Yeah, grain selection matters too. Yeah, it's really going to be hard to get around it. 70 to 80% of that flavor profile is coming from wort, and we're not really able to mask it and pick up on some of those lower threshold compounds. What comes to mind is like thiols from hops, for example. Like it's really hard to get that type of expression because you can't solubilize those things into your base. And again, these flavors are present in all wort, just they're not odor active in ethanol. So it's like almost also removing our bias for what we think beer should taste like, because we're making beer with the ingredient of ethanol, if you will, at a very, very low rate. So there are ways that you can, add different grains that aren't going to add that fermentability into it, and therefore you're going to have lower presence of that. But methionyl's odor active, at a pretty low level. So you're likely to pick it up no matter what.
And the other issue is I'm a relatively new home brewer, so
yay,
don't go by
welcome
anything I say. But during the pandemic, I made 9 different beers.
Amazing.
Right? Just started. I only made 1 or 2 before that.
Great.
What I found is when you get into craft beer, when you get into home brewing, you get much more selective about what you drink. So you're more mindful of what you put in your mouth. So that helps, in some ways, helps you drink less beer.
Yes.
The other thing is when you really like brewing beer, the tasting isn't as important as the fun of making something new. So both those things decrease my consumption of alcohol, I think. And I was a graduate student, went to college a couple times, so I know drinking a lot of beer. And I also don't understand why I could drink 6 beers, but as the doctors want, I can't drink 6 glasses of water.
So I have the same problem.
I don't know what that is, but thank you.
You're very welcome. Good. And non-alcoholic beer helps solve that for me, right? I stay hydrated by drinking. I drink NA beer every day starting at 8 a.m. And so there's a lot of health benefits I think I've experienced from that. I notice that I have less inflammation because I'm drinking things with hops in it. Hop alpha acid and beta acid presence are anti-inflammatory by nature. These are the cousin of cannabis, right? It's a great matrix, I think, eventually for cannabis beverages, actually, is alcohol-free beer. So, but yeah, thank you for sharing. I think that's great because some of the things I would expect you as a home brewer to experience if you implement this at home or just start drinking more non-alcoholic beer is you're going to feel better. You're going to have all the benefits. What we notice, people sleep better. They tend to feel like their mental acuity is a bit sharper. They tend to see less inflammation. These are well-validated studies around basically people doing dry January and reporting how they feel after 30 days. So just by implementing it and being more mindful, like, hey, I'm going to drink NA beer the first half of my day and then switch to regular stuff, you'll probably see some benefit from that. Do you guys want me to talk about, we can just taste it. I don't have to walk you through a formal tasting. I have that on here because I wanted to make sure we had enough time for questions. But hopefully you pick up on the dry hop aroma. Yeah? Yeah, everyone? Yes? And it's not, you probably noticed that because we adjust that pH down, you've almost got like a kind of like a tartness to it a little bit, which is done on purpose, but that's stabilizing the beverage. And there's enough bitterness in there because of my mess up that I think that this actually presents as quite a nice NA beer. Although we did not, you probably noticed even with the carbonation, it's still not quite where we wanted. And even that malt adjustment didn't give us like a nice pillow of foam. That was a critique that I would have. But other than that, I think from a drinkability standpoint, this holds pretty strong.
Is this 0% by the way?
This is about 0.39, 0.4, yeah.
Thanks for the talk. Really interesting. This has been something that we've, in the last year, but I'm from Gnomebrew. We're a homebrew shop in Chicago, and a lot of our customers are very interested in it. This is like a lot of growth, you know. And as you said, there's a lot of people, you know, people who like to drink beer, like to drink alcohol, but like to have some diversity in their week and in their day.
Yes.
So there's a lot of opportunity. And a lot of questions from customers, a lot of questions from us. We've been trying to work on it.
Great.
We probably brewed about a dozen batches now. We start off, it seems like the way you did, kind of following the White Labs, you know, recipe.
Yep.
That's kind of looked pretty familiar there. However, I have a ton of questions. I'm going to keep just a couple. But first off, I think the White Labs instructions recommended mashing at like 168, and it looks like you went way over that. Can you explain why?
We wanted to be absolutely, in this case, I wanted to be absolutely sure the beer would come in at what would be a under 0.5. Like, I was trying to make, to see how difficult that would be to do.
Yeah.
Knowing that if I went a little lower, I could be activating, you know, alpha amylase, and I could see a different fermentation. I wasn't sure. So that was basically why the ultra-low guys recommended that. They're like, if you definitely want to be really low, just mash at that higher temperature. Now, if you want to be a little bit more flexible, I think you could probably drop that a little bit. If you're like, hey, you know, we don't care. We're a homebrew club. 0.9 is fine with us, but we want maximum expression of fermentation character, something which is a little more restrained than this.
Yeah, so we've gone back and forth with different temperatures and brewing methods, from kind of brew in a bag to sort of, you know, highly, you know, all-in-one electric with like high precision, you know, temperature. And, you know, it seems like there's a very fine line between getting an extremely starchy product and a very not. But this is not particularly starchy seeming, and you had a really high mash. Do you think that's just because of the grain selection or
pH?
Is the pH okay?
pH is going to change flavor. Yeah,
so,
expression.
You know,
I
know that for the food safety like guidelines, it's 4.6, I believe, is that so at the pitch. So you said you wanted to target 3.7. Now, are you targeting that at pitch, or are you readjusting after fermentation?
We did this pre-boil.
You adjusted to 3.7 pre-boil.
Yeah.
Okay, so how much pH change is happening during boil and fermentation?
Interesting. We didn't measure that, but measure that, and pH stayed stable after we changed because, you know, we really dropped it.
So why before boil, just for the like the coagulation?
I think we did it, yeah, for that reason. We just wanted to make, that was when they recommended. We obviously used a product to adjust pH, so that was just in the process when we did it. We knew that the rest of our process wasn't going to impact the outcome.
Right.
And so I think there's different, and I definitely when I read the study that the ultra-low guys had done and looked into some other studies, it seemed like you could make that adjustment at any time. It did also, again, because it was for stability and I knew we were going to be transferring, I really wanted to make sure we were being really careful about that when we're homebrewing stuff. The idea of making somebody sick made me nervous.
Yeah, yeah,
so,
absolutely.
Yeah, I was
sure,
like,
yeah.
Right, you know, yeah. We knew at that pH we were going to be solid.
We've
even
put, like, sorbate at the end, just to, you know, the keg. Just
which is what a lot of people have to do, yep, sorbate and benzoate.
Just as a triple precaution, and, you know.
Yep.
And if I'll indulge myself, one last question. You mentioned that, you know, like, IPAs lend themselves really well to NAs. I've always kind of had the opposite. You know, one of the first kind of NA beers I tried that I actually thought was decent was, I mean, this is, you know, might be scoffed at, but O'Doul's Amber.
Mm-hmm.
The green one is disgusting, but I think the amber is decent. Because, I mean, and, you know, it seemed to me like specialty malts, like caramel malts and stuff, like that's, you know, we always teach them, you know, it's specialty malts are what adds color and flavor, base malts add, you know, alcohol.
Yeah.
Right? So why not, you know, we're trying like an amber ale. We think that's going to be maybe a cool. know, winner. But that's because, you know, you get a lot of unfermentable things in there. Have you, do you know, I mean, I, you know, I know that you personally didn't do too much with that, but I mean, your clients and whatnot, do they have a lot of, you know, experience with using caramel malts and other, you know, like lower fermentable, you know, roasted stuff with low enzyme kind of grains?
Well, David, you are bringing up I happen to be fortunate enough to have had dinner 2 years ago with the guy who created O'Doul's at AB, yeah. And he was a very interesting guy. Told me a lot about it. I don't know if you know this, but actually Anheuser-Busch has a process called wort stripping. And if you look into what that process that they use, that was what they use for O'Doul. And so, for O'Doul. So I would imagine that because of that process, they're actually stripping out a lot of that extra wort character. So it'd be interesting to see what your evaluation is when you do it and compare it to like a commercial product that used a method to actually try to knock out some of that wort flavor. They actually run it over kind of a series of, I'm going to be totally butchering the right way to describe this, but it almost looks like stairs. And that's going to aerate the wort a little bit and knock out some of those flavors. Oh, okay. And then they were basically doing that, you know, doing that process to eliminate that. I'd be interested to see how that works for you. I also live part-time in Illinois and part-time in Michigan, so I should come in when
absolutely.
You guys do this. I would love that. That'd be really cool. That'd be amazing. Yeah, thank
Please
you. Talk, yeah. yeah, cheers. Appreciate that. Hi, Jim.
Quick follow-on to his pH question.
Yeah.
You said pre-boil, so not mash, right? Once you finish your mash. Okay, and then the hop oils. Are you talking about like the hop extract we buy at the homebrew shop or something different?
You got it, my friend. We just use like hops oil that was available. I mean, there's a lot of these, the really good hop stuff, like because I worked in this industry, like isn't even available at the homebrewing level yet. But I know BSG just started carrying some stuff from Totally Natural Solutions, which in my opinion has their process is super critical CO2 fractionation, so it's super clean. You know, that the input material gets highly concentrated. It's a 1% solution in PG, so it's very easy. A lot of the other companies will just sell you hop oil distillate, and then you've got to do that blend yourself, which Josh was so annoyed because we were gone, you know, like when he had to do this hop oil distillate, he had to do like 300 drops of this, like count them. And he's like, oh, that was terrible. I never want to do that again. But I do believe there's better solutions at the homebrew level that will be available and super encouraging for homebrewers that want to implement that.
I was going to ask about that. How much did you put into the batch?
300 and something drops is what I know in about 5 gallons.
Awesome. This is delicious. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Thank you. Hi, Beth.
Hi. My question has more to do with when can we expect to see the guidelines come out or some guidelines come out for tasting and evaluation of the NA products?
Oh, thank you for asking that question. I think I might need some volunteers with that. I actually was invited to be to teach at the very first World Alcohol Free Awards this year. I trained all their judges in beer because that was my question. I was like, so how was it held in the UK? And I believe in February, maybe early March. And we just announced the winners actually. But I asked that question. So how are your judges being trained? What are the parameters in which you're using to evaluate NA beer? And it was like crickets. So I think that's a huge opportunity. I would love to see us do some work in the guidelines. I'm also a BJCP judge, and I'm left out to dry right now. I did all this work, and I can't use it because I don't, you know, I'm not judging regular beer competitions anymore. So I'd love to see some work done in that area for sure.
Love to help you.
Thank you. That's awesome.
Hi.
Hi.
I assume that you cake your beer with false carbonate. That's what you did here, is that right?
Yeah, we had it in our vessel, we force carved it, yep.
Yeah, do you have any tips for if people typically bottle condition their beers? See, it's tricky because you're going to push your ABV up a bit.
Yes.
But is there any way you've found of doing it or that you would recommend?
That's an awesome question. I mean, there are like small carb tablets you can use, but again, I don't know what those interactions would be if there's like still any like yeast presence.
Well,
I'm not sure.
We found that they add for about 330ml bottles, so a typical size, about 0.5% of alcohol for one.
Okay, wow.
But it's obviously the amount of yeast in there as well, and trying to preserve it, trying to avoid in growing it.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'd probably say you want to just save some back and just be mm-hmm. checking your gravities on it. Because again, if you're making it at home, does it really matter if you're a 0.5% or you're 0.9 or 1.1? I mean, you're in the range. It's, if you're not going to try to be on the shelf, it's like, hey, you're still achieving like a very no or low alcohol brew that's going to, you know, it's gonna, you would really not be able to become intoxicated from that. So that's a really great point, is like, hey, I realize a lot of people are trying to bottle this stuff and carbonation is an issue. So you that is one way you could maybe potentially come around that, unless if you're not doing it in a vessel. Yeah, it's a great, Nick. Thank you. Yeah. Hi, Austin.
Hi. Tell me your thoughts on cold mashing. You know, mashing around 32 degrees, you know, overnight.
Yeah, so there was a talk at a previous homebrew con a couple of years ago. I can't remember if it was White Labs or Wallman. Somebody gave a great talk, and they actually called out kind of like cold mashing as like a method. We address it in our training, but it just seems like it's difficult, just in terms of like being able to even get it to start in the first place. So I couldn't speak from it from experience. I'm aware of it as a method. Has anybody else here? Raise your hand if you have. You tried cold contact? You have? How'd it work out?
Not great.
Okay, so we're validating that it's challenging. Okay. Yeah. Were you able to get fermentation to start?
Yes, I was.
How?
Pitching a lot of yeast.
Okay. So can become inefficient too, I would imagine. But that's not to say other strains won't come out that can operate in those conditions, because that category is evolving rapidly. But everything I read, it just was more difficult. So these high temp mashes seem to be able to give us just enough fermentable sugar where we, and you're just pitching like that one, you know, our case we made just about 6 gallons. So one pack of yeast was plenty, and we achieved fermentation in a few days, and it just was a little less flavorful.
Yeah.
More bitter and more flat than we were hoping for.
Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
I guess my question is, do you know of any maltose-free or maltose-negative yeast that have any phenolic character that are coming out? I just noticed everything was like clean or like light fruit ester or something of that nature.
Yeah, I mean, I interviewed Lallemand for my book that I'm writing. I'm writing a book, the first book I'm aware of on AF and NA beers, like a study manual to our stuff. It's like, you know, just over 100 pages. And I did talk to them, and they had all different kinds of cool descriptors of things they were working on to, you know, but yeah, you're typically, if you're going to see phenolic compound in a yeast for an NA, it's 4-vinyl guaiacol. You can get a little clovey in there, but yeah, there's opportunity for that for sure. I would just say go look on the website and look for those flavor attributes, and they're always, you know, offering new ones. But from what I understand about what's available and what you can get right now, they'd be strains that would primarily be putting 4VG in there for you. Yeah.
Perfect.
Sorry if this was covered. Walked in a little bit late.
That's okay.
What's the best way to combat the thin body that's normally found in the low and no alcohol beers?
Yeah, that's a great question. He's asking about body, like the body being thin, and whenever you take ethanol out of something, you lose a lot of that complex warming mouthfeel character. Hop components. I have been using hop components successfully to adjust commercial recipes for global brewers since 2019. I can tell you that's what they do. Like, if you get it and you're like, it's just not quite there, we'll use, like, beta acids from hops, for example. Again, this is stuff that's not really available yet at a homebrewing scale, but beta acids from hops can not only protect the beer from microbials, but they also have no flavor impact. So there's things like that you can do to adjust, but just a little bit of hop oil used correctly, I think, gives you a little bit more structure. And then, you know, you can use different types of malts, but again, you just want to be really mindful of what you're putting in there so you don't achieve something that's just too sweet. Get it used both together, yeah, in my opinion. Thanks, Andrew.
Adding hop oil back in is fascinating. I've never heard that method. That's very cool. How does that compare to, say, adding maltodextrin? Maltodextrin? Just adding maltodextrin to increase body.
Adding maltodextrin.
That seems to be a common method used by NA brewing groups, stuff like that. I have been told about. In fact, I picked up some. I've not tried it yet.
Oh, certainly. Okay. Well, you'll have to let us know.
But I'm wondering if that actually, if you can use that, if you have tried that.
No, we haven't. This was actually my first take at doing this, and I have never adjusted a commercial recipe using that.
Very similar to Sam Adams' Just the Haze, which I have two cans of in my room, and it's remarkably similar with less carbonation, but But
it's, oh, that's awesome.
It's excellent.
Yeah, very cool. Well, yeah, we haven't tried that, but that would be interesting. And I know that, you know, that was something that I know is going to, we'll see more best practices come out from the craft level, because like I said, now with biological methods, more brewers don't need to do that CapEx outlay to produce these types of beers. We're just seeing more and more offerings that are done through a biological method with other adjustments being experimented with on the back end to sort of mask maybe some undesirable flavor compound formation. So, yeah.
I may have missed this because I had to leave for a second, but do you have a particular kind of yeast besides you talked about the for your book, and you spoke about the phenolic positive, Peggy's pure positive yeast. That seems to be the best thing. But as far as specifically in a yeast, like LA01, stuff like that.
Yes.
Do you know of what is available at Duhon Brewers at all?
Yeah. Somebody else kind of asked a similar question to that. And I would say just check the websites and look. And if you go to the Ultra Low Brewers guys site, they use regular beer yeast in theirs, and they like it. They say that you don't even actually have to use a specific yeast. That's their philosophy. I haven't tried that yet, but that's what they say.
I tried Third Runnings. It works perfectly.
Yeah, there you go.
I don't know.
Awesome. Yeah. Cool. Awesome. Yeah, thank you. We probably have to... Yeah, one more question? Okay, awesome. Yay. Best for last. Here we go.
I'll make it a good one here. Megan, this is an amazing talk. You got me so interested in it. I'm standing here right now on behalf of the BJCP. Will you help me write this?
Oh, yes. Don't make me cry during this talk.
Seriously, yeah. I would love to. With your help, we could get it turned out pretty quick.
Yeah, that would be amazing. We'd love to help. Thank you. Yeah, thanks, guys.